If you'll turn to your Bibles, Brian read for you Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 23. Before I get into what I'm going to share today, I wanted to kind of give you an idea of where I'm going to be going. My basic theme today will be discussing the witness that surrounds us in creation and how it testifies of the power of God, the existence of God, and something tells us something about the character of God. I'll share with you some information about creation, and hopefully that'll build in you an appreciation for the complexity and the simplicity, if that's not a double talk or double speak in a sense, of just the great testimony we have in creation of what God is like, because He made it and He is the Creator. I'll share a little bit about science, some problems maybe it has, as well as some neat things it has about it as far as interpreting creation. Hopefully we'll learn from that how to be more established in our faith and how to appreciate the witness of creation, and how it can help us worship Him maybe in a more a loving way and appreciative manner. In Romans, Paul begins the book of Romans sharing about the gospel and the righteousness of God. And then he leads into, in verse 18, starts talking about the wrath of God. In that verse 18, it says, "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness." Basically, we need to understand that the wrath of God is a little different than the wrath that we maybe extend out to our spouse or our children or someone at work. Our wrath can sometimes not be very consistent. It can be motivated by the wrong reason or attitude. It can often be unjustified. Sometimes there can be pride involved. God's wrath is never that way. It's always perfect and holy and just. It's divine, and it's very, very fair. So when we talk about the wrath of God, we talk about something that is meted out as a punishment because it's deserved. In the scripture, it talks about that God's wrath is being revealed from heaven against wickedness and sinfulness. And basically, that kind of has the idea of being uncovered or continually being known. An example of that is if you look at creation and what we live with death and decay all the time. And that's basically a judgment that came down from the sin of Adam and Eve. And it's kind of a form of God's wrath that constantly we live with. It talks here also about just the consequences of that in kind of in verse 19, as God continues and says, "Since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them." Basically, Paul's trying to get across the idea that the evidence that's in creation, the witness, the testimony that's there, is very convicting. It's very, very plain to men, and they're without excuse. Ezekiel 18:4 talks about it in this regard as far as God's wrath, and puts it kind of bluntly, "The soul that sins shall die." There's, in a sense, a moral order that God has, is that if you sin, you'll pay for that. I wanted to quote a famous historian, J.F. Froude. He said, "One lesson and one lesson only history may be said to repeat with distinctness, that the world is built somehow on moral foundations, that in the long run it is well with the good, and in the long run it will be ill with the wicked." Now, some of you may ask, well, I'm not sure if I believe that or understand that, because I see crime and violence and all kinds of horrible things happening all the time, and I'm not seeing God's wrath being evidenced against those people. And that's a good question, but I think we also have to understand that sometimes God's wrath is delayed. And an analogy I heard once compared it kind of to pulling back a bowstring on a bow, that sometimes God pulls back the bowstring of wrath and shoots the arrow of His judgment quickly, and sometimes He holds it. And as the wickedness and the sinfulness continues, He continues to pull back the bowstring. And that's kind of spooky, because if you're in a situation of living in sin, committing willful sin against the Lord, disobedience, and you think, well, gee, I'm getting away with it, the bowstring's just getting tighter. And when that's released, the consequences of that arrow go very deep into your personal life. While we think about the wrath of God being just, it is just. And while you may get away with it for a season, there is an ultimate payment. And God does not ignore that in the end. This passage goes on in verse 20. It says, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse." What this basically says to you, if you're a non-believer here today, is that basically you don't have an excuse to say, "I don't have enough proof that God exists," or "No one ever told me that God exists." What this scripture says is, you know. If you're a believer here, there's a strong encouragement that all around you, in all of nature, there's a testimony that builds up your faith that God exists, and that he cares about you, and that everything he says is true. One of the great early Christian fathers, Tertullian, said, "It was not the pen of Moses that initiated the knowledge of the Creator. The vast majority of mankind, though they had never heard the name of Moses, to say nothing of his book, know the God of Moses nonetheless. Nature, he said, is the teacher. The soul is the pupil. If I offer you a rose, you will not scorn its creator." And another great story that kind of illustrates this is the story of Helen Keller. She was deaf, mute, and blind, and had no really good form of communication to the outside world. And until Ann Sullivan came by to spend hours and days and months working with her, trying to build a communication link, she really had no communication, in a sense. Ann Sullivan used the opportunity, when she finally was able to communicate with Helen Keller, she wanted to tell her about the God of the universe, the Creator. Helen's response was, "Well, I know him, I just didn't know his name." I think that's one of the strongest evidences that I could imagine that God is around us in creation. We're without excuse. It goes on in that passage to say in verses 21 through 23, "For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles." Our society is greatly influenced by science and technology. And I think we're unique in that ways. Basically, when you think about what we're exposed to with television and information and education and all kinds of media material, there's just a heavy dose of science and technology. What you have to remember is that science had its base in Christianity, a very strong base. Many of the early scientists were strong Christians, and what motivated them to study and spend so much time researching creation and learning more about it and what made it happen was the fact that they felt that they could find more out about God in that way. And so many of the early scientists were deeply committed Christians seeking to know more about their Lord. But what's happened is that moral base has changed. It's almost like a chicken and egg thing. I'm not sure which came first, but either the climate of morals changed, and therefore scientists who are now studying and researching are interpreting facts differently, or the scientists interpreted the facts differently, began promoting this to the populations and society's social climate change as far as their morals and ethics. It's hard to say, maybe it's both. But what you have to remember as Christians is that we're being exposed to an interpretation of scientific fact that has a base in assumptions coming from scientists that sometimes are not of the same faith or the same attitude that we are. It doesn't mean that you should be intimidated by that, but you need to be discerning. The biggie, probably, that involves the interpretation of creation and scientific fact is, of course, evolution, and that's a whole other talk that I won't get into today, but I did want to share a quote that I think really capsulizes sort of the feelings of some scientists who have a moral commitment against God. This is a quote from Dr. George Wall, professor of biology at Harvard University, and he wrote an article in Scientific American entitled Life, Origins, and Evolution. And I want you to listen carefully because he makes a statement here of basically intellectual suicide, and basically we might call it spiritual suicide. He says, "When it comes to the origin of life, we have only two possibilities as to how life arose. One is spontaneous generation arising to evolution. The other is a supernatural creative act of God. There is no third possibility. Spontaneous generation was scientifically disproved 100 years ago by Louis Pasteur, Spallanzani, Reddy, and others. That leads us scientifically to only one possible conclusion, that life arose as a supernatural creative act of God." At this point, you'd say, great, he's got a good mind. He understands that life didn't arise out of nothing by accident, that it was created by God. But listen to what he says. "I will not accept that philosophically because I do not want to believe in God. Therefore, I choose to believe in that which I know is scientifically impossible, spontaneous generation arising to evolution." So I don't think I have to say too much more. I'm not saying that all scientists are bad, because in a sense I consider myself sort of a scientist. But I think we have to be careful when we watch National Geographic, read certain books, and what we are exposed to. You have to remember that there are basic assumptions to how people are interpreting creation and how they respond to that. And that's what gets back to Romans. Is someone responding to the witness of creation and believing it and acting on it and believing in the Lord, or are they becoming fools and worshiping their own knowledge? I won't go into it now because we're behind time, but if you want a homework assignment, go home and read Job 38 through about 41. And it gets into some confrontation between God and Job about who's the boss, sort of like, who's the creator. And it asks some very, very good questions. What I'd like to do now is show you some slides and talk a little bit basically about creation and show you some examples. Basically, I wanted to show you this slide, just an illustration of the marvelous creation of birds. There's over 5 billion birds in America. Some can fly 500 miles across the Gulf of Mexico. Mallards can fly at 60 miles per hour, eagles at 100 miles per hour, and falcons can dive at 180 miles per hour. As I go through this, I want you to remember that the originator, the guy who thought up the ideas behind all this, is God our Father. I think we can relate to that in some regards. This is basically a bird that's fishing. Those of you that are fishermen out there, I don't know if you can see it down here, but let's see if my light works here. I don't know. There it is. This is his bait, and it could be a piece of wood or a twig or whatever, but he's thrown into the water and he's waiting to catch the fish that he's got in his mouth here. So basically this is something that this species does on a regular basis. This is an anglerfish. It's a sea fish that basically has a little fishing pole here. See this little kind of filament of tissue, and at the end there's some more of a glob of tissue up here, and he wiggles that, okay? And then as another fish comes by, it's intrigued by that little wiggling object and thinks it's a piece of something he could eat. And as you notice, he looks kind of like his surrounding rocks and seabed. And as the fish comes by to grab that to eat, he grabs it instead. This is something like, you might ask yourself, if you were an evolutionist, how many years or thousands or millions of years did it take for fish to grow out a little filament so that, you know, it's successful, you know, and maybe they tried different lures over the millions of years, you know. But basically, I think if you view creation as a witness of what God did, you just feel, hey, it was planned that way from the beginning. This is a water spider that literally lives underwater a significant part of its life. It uses its abdomen and the hairs on the abdomen to grab air bubbles from the surface, and you can see behind here a nest that's built around some plants with its silk web, and it lives under the water in this air bubble and plants its eggs in this air bubble. Again, how many spiders had to drown over the millions of years to make that work? Here's just a typical garden spider. There's a lot of things that are interesting about this. The only thing I really wanted to talk about was the silk web that it produces. Basically, the silk is being studied constantly by scientists trying to duplicate it. By weight, it's 5 times stronger than steel, and it can be stretched 130 times its length before it breaks. So they're trying to discover how can we synthesize this to make clothing out of it and ropes and things like that. It's intriguing because the types of webs that the spiders spin are specific to the species. So you can almost identify a spider by the type and form of its web. You might also ask the question is, when a spider runs across the web to get its food, to kill it and wrap it up in a cocoon, how come it doesn't get caught in its own web? Well, the reason for that is the radial spokes of the web are dry, they're not sticky, and the ones that go concentric in rings are sticky. And so what it does is, if you go out in your garage, you know the daddy long legs that builds the webs all over creation unless you have woods pest control? Well, if you walk out there, those are orb spinning spiders. They're kind of blind, but they're sensitive to motion and movement and that sort of thing. So if you shake the web, they'll run over there. Well, what they're doing is they're running on the dry drag lines of the web so they don't get stuck in their own web. And they also use the silk out of the abdomen for what's called ballooning, which means as they spin webs out their abdomen, and then the wind catches it and it transports them over into another part of the forest or the woods, and they travel that way. Again, I think it just as you start studying creation and nature, the intricateness and the complexity of nature, you start saying, how in the world did God think about all this stuff? I threw this in just to show you how God designs nature to match and symbiotically kind of relate to one another in the sense that polar bears are colored appropriate for their environment, and they have many other features that make them able to survive in that kind of environment, thick fur. This is a flounder. You're seeing one side of the fish, and so both eyes are on one side of the fish, and the fish blends into its surrounding environment, and it can actually change color to some extent depending on the color of the gravel that it's laying in. And basically here's a little fin here, and there's another fin on the other side that's kind of vestigial, but basically it lays on its side on the ocean. And the eyes, the way they're arranged that way, it's to look for predators that might be stalking it, and that's part of what the camouflage is for, but it's also looking for things that it could grab and eat. So it can sneak up on things and it can hide from things that's after it. This is a slide that depicts a living cell that you have millions of in your body, and each cell is specialized many times depending on the organ you're talking about. But the reason I threw this in was just to show you, this is an enlarged cell. I mean, these are microscopic. The only way you could see these is under a microscope, and they make you live and walk and breathe and talk and think, in a sense. They still, while they've been able to break down the chromosomes that are in the nucleus, kind of understand what certain chromosomes do, they still haven't solved the mystery of what gives life life, what gives it breath, and I think we know the answer to that. But basically parts in here, this is a mitochondria, which gives the cell, it's kind of the powerhouse of the cell, it breaks down nutrients and supplies it to the cell so it keeps it alive. And some new research says that you get your mitochondria from your mother. So they're starting to do studies about how to trace back species by studying where the mitochondria came from and what types of mitochondria are in a cell. These are the centrioles up here. Again, there's not going to be a test on Monday on all this, but these are the centrioles, which have to do with cell division. If you get cut, you've got to repair yourself. So basically, cell division causes repair through multiplication of cells, and also that's why you grow. But getting back to the curse of creation, that judgment, we die because we wear out. The process tends to break down as you get older, and that's part of the curse that God's put on us because of Adam and Eve's sin. This is the nucleus here, the nucleoli. If you were given this as a homework assignment, I want you to design something that in thousands of combinations will cause living things to walk on the earth and be of different types. I mean, this is what God developed. This is something that I make a living at, in a sense. This is a cross-section of the eye. I'll just discuss a little bit because there's thousands of things I could tell you about vision that would almost make you a Christian if you weren't. Basically, the red here is the retina of the eye. That's what you see with. There's about a million nerve fibers that exit the eye and go back to the brain. And you don't see with your eyes, you see with your brain. Your eyes are extension of nerve tissue from the brain. They're actually arms of the brain that reach out and gather light energy. And that light energy passes through the eye, through the cornea and the lens of the eye, goes through the retina, bounces off the pigment epithelium that's at the back, bounces back through the retina, and causes a chemical reaction in the retina that's changed into electrical energy, and then that electrical energy is transmitted through the optic nerve back to the occipital cortex of your brain. That's where the pictures form. Now, if that wasn't amazing enough, everything gets back to the brain upside down, and the brain flips it right side up. You might not believe me when I say that, but a guy did a study. He wore a pair of lenses for several months that flipped everything upside down, so he saw everything upside down. He lived, breathed, took showers, slept, everything with this headgear on. And after a while, his brain compensated and flipped it back the right way. Then when he took the headgear off after that experiment, everything was upside down. He had to relearn it. And his main statement when he had got done with that was, don't do it at home, because he was throwing up all the time. But basically, it shows you that we have a very intricate human body that is just, I'm speechless. What do you say? Another thing I'll share is that you have what's called an accommodative or focusing mechanism, where as you see something, as you go to read, the retina senses that through a nerve loop and causes this muscle here, ciliary muscle, to contract. It releases tension on these little zonule fibers here. Lens of your eye has a natural tendency to want to get fatter to become more powerful to read. So when that happens, you're able to read things up close because of this nervous response causing the muscle to flex, causing the zonule fibers to get loose, and this gets fatter. And we won't talk about those people that are over 40, because I'm in that category now, of why the lens doesn't work that way anymore and you've got to have bifocals and reading glasses. But that's just something about sight. I took a botany class in college, and which is the study of flowers. That was where, in college, I started really being convicted by creation, of God's testimony in creation, as far as just the complexity of things. This is a morning glory, and I've kind of ripped open a morning glory flower. Basically, you can see here that there's all kinds of anatomical parts in a flower. Right here at the tip, this here and this here and this here are anthers that contain pollen. And basically they get tousled by the wind and bees and get deposited right here on the tip of the pistil. And then what happens is these microscopic grains of pollen start growing a tube down through the pistil, down into the ovary where they fertilize and create seeds. Okay, now again, when you look at who devised this kind of system and did it evolve, I'm believing God our Creator did. Another class I took was entomology, which is the study of insects. We had to identify certain bugs. This is an electron microscope of a common housefly. And in both these classes, I had to identify species, 100 species of plants or 100 species of insects. And we had to get microscopes, bend up wings, and count how many hairs there were behind a little wing plate to identify the species. And so, again, what it told me or convicted me of is that every species is different, and God's created all these things, and they're just intricateness. When you look at man's creations, as you start looking at it under a microscope, it becomes more and more imperfect. You see flaws. When you do it to God's creation, you see even more detail. And it starts getting mind-boggling, the detail that God has put in creation. And I think this is what Romans is talking about as far as the evidence is there. And you almost maybe ask the question, how in the world could scientists, as they study and get deeper in God's creation, how could they start questioning who did this? And I think sometimes it really just comes from the moral base. Like the quote said, I just choose not to believe in that. I don't want to believe in God, so I'll choose what I want to believe. These are leaf-cutting ants. For some reason, God created them to have an urge to cut leaves up, carry them back to their nest, chew them up, and let fungus grow on them for a food source. And what they've found out is that the fungus is dependent on this particular species of ant because it doesn't produce spores to regenerate itself. So it has to be transmitted from nest to nest by these ants, and that's the way it survives. So there's a relationship there many, many times in nature. I wanted just to share a little bit about paleontology, which is a study of fossil life, life that lived, depending on what you believe, thousands and millions of years ago, evolutionists, or thousands and tens of thousands of years ago if you're a creationist. These are diatoms, which are skeletons of microscopic life. This is a microscope slide. It's kind of like snowflakes, just the intricateness and the detail work and the variety of all the different species of diatoms. And they basically, that's how they identify diatoms and do dating. These are just some slides that talks about what life might have been in the fossil times, however you interpret that. I tend to lean towards the creationist viewpoint. Humongous dragonflies with a wingspan of 3 feet. Dinosaurs of all kinds of shapes and varieties. All the variety that we have today, we're living in the time of dinosaurs. I was going to share with you, too, they've discovered a new dinosaur called an ultrasaur. It stood 60 feet tall, and that puts it high enough to put its head into a fifth-story window. There's a lot of debate now about whether the dinosaurs are warm-blooded or cold-blooded, whether they took care of their young. There's a lot of belief that they took care of their young. They didn't just leave them to hatch on their own, like modern reptiles, and there is some suspicion that they were warm-blooded. Something that you have to understand about science is that it constantly changes, so what's fact today becomes error tomorrow. And so I think the scientists should be humble enough to admit that basically they have to be careful that when they start talking about fact, that it's fact and not just a theory that tomorrow can become false. This is a certain species of pterodactyl. It was like a flying dinosaur, and recently they found one of these which had a wingspan of 51 feet. And that's larger than the 38-foot wingspan of a Phantom IV jet. Not only was God extremely wise and creative today, but in the past, life that doesn't exist anymore. This is astronomy. I've never taken an astronomy class, but I've read some books and I've been interested in it. And our planet is 25,000 miles in circumference and weighs 6,588 sextillion tons and hangs in empty space. It spins at 1,000 miles per hour with perfect precision so that time is kept to the split second. And the Earth careens through space around the Sun in an orbit of 580 million miles at over 1,000 miles per minute. The Milky Way galaxy, if you were to travel across the galaxy in which our solar system is located at the speed of 186,000 miles per second, it would take you 125,000 years to cross it. This is basically an example of the Milky Way galaxy. This is called the Whirlpool, but the Milky Way looks exactly like this. I think we're located somewhere about up in there, but no, I'm just kidding. But basically, there are millions of these galaxies in the universe. So you start thinking about the immenseness of creation, just the uniqueness of Earth. As I went through school and as I watched TV programs, it convicts me that there's a testimony in creation that's there, our Creator, and how He designed creation and how it works, and that as you study it and look at it, as you look at the mountains that surround us, there's just this awesome conviction that God exists and that we can respond to that. What I would do is I would ask you, if you're a non-believer today, to think about what I presented and what Scripture says about the witness and the testimony that's there. I would hope that you're convicted to respond to the Lord and seek Him out. If you're a Christian, I hope that you've seen that just the awesomeness of God's creation and how that moves us to love Him more, establish our faith, and worship Him in a more loving way.